I sat down on the bed next to you, you started to cry. I said, maybe if I turn on an episode of Columbia House Party, you'll want me to come back home. Guys, thanks so much for listening. And if you are one of the people supporting us on Patreon, thanks so much, guys. We really appreciate it. You can check us out on Twitter and Instagram and patreon.com/Columbia House Party. You know all that stuff.
Yeah.
Today's a special...
Today's going to be fun. I'm
special
excited.
Day. Special day. Special album. Special guest.
I finished my notes yesterday and when I said to Cassie, I was like, ooh, I'm excited about this one. She said, why? And I said, because it's Wilco. And she said, okay. And that was how I discuss music with Cassie sometimes.
So... obviously, there are a lot of options when you do a band like Wilco. I think there are three primary ones that people probably were wondering what we said last week. We were doing Wilco. I think most people would have assumed one particular album, and then there are three that maybe we could have done.
Yeah, I think that's right.
But when you have a guest of this magnitude on an episode, they call the shots.
It's true.
If you want to land a guest like this, when you send the lengthy email and outline to their PR handler, there are conditions that come back.
I think picking this album is actually the first time the guest and I have agreed about something with music.
All right, Jake.
So that's nice.
Tell us, set us up here.
To set this up, I'm going to take you back to the year 2011. I just moved back to Toronto from Montreal. I'd just been dumped. I was in a very bad headspace.
But at least you were out of Montreal.
But at least I was out of Montreal, which is always a good thing. And I was working in a restaurant as a server and a bartender, which is also not a great thing to do in a bad headspace. And the only thing I was allowed to be in charge of in the restaurant was the restaurant iPod. I was not allowed to load anything on it, but I got to choose what from the iPod was played. There's only three bands on the iPod I liked. One was Nico Case, one was The Decemberists, and the other was Wilco. But there's only one Wilco album on the iPod. So I spent the 6 or so months I spent working at this place listening to this album over and over and over again. And half of it is not a good album to play in a restaurant when people are around, but that didn't stop me. The album that we're talking about today is by Wilco, and it is not Yankee Hotel Foxtrot. It's the next one. So we're talking about A Ghost Is Born today.
The greatest lost track of all time. Liquid's turpentine. You can't hear it on the radio. You can't hear it anywhere you go. The best band will never get signed. Kiss that star and put your blind. So good you won't ever know. They never even played a show. You can't hear them on the radio.
Help us talk about A Ghost Is Born. Ah, so excited. Hey, Steve.
Fellas.
Hey, man.
Guys, we're joined today by Steve Slatkowski. If anyone doesn't know, Steve is the guitarist in Pup, a Toronto-based ska band. their album, Morbid Stuff, was, you know, on pretty much every good top albums of 2019 list. It was very high on mine. It was very high on Jake's. Pretty low on Steve's, if I remember, but...
yeah. A little too much tonality on that.
Oh, boy. This is going to be a show.
you guys can find Steve on Twitter at Sladcow. The band is at Pup the Band. You can go to pupthband.com. They have some truly great merch on there. Steve, brought you on to talk about Wilco, A Ghost Is Born. There are obviously a lot of albums we could have done with you. Why did this one stick out to you as one you wanted to do with us?
You know, I think Wilco being sort of probably my favorite band, and Ghost Is Born kind of being the record that, as much as Yankee Hotel Foxtrot was kind of the big albatross, this was my proper introduction to the band, I think. I was a little young still, even in 2002, and kind of got into that record, as everyone kind of did in high school, but later. But this one came out kind of right around the time that I was, you know, really going to shows regularly. And probably one of the more formative concert experiences of my life was on this record. And, you know, it was like the other day I was listening to it and just going back and being like, I know every fucking word. Like, every single one, still, to this day. Wilco are an interesting band because they kind of, there are a lot of, like, periods in terms of, like, there's sort of that early post-Uncle Tupelo thing where you get AM and Being There. And even kind of into Summer Teeth, there's sort of this kind of emphasis on sort of bare bones, like, alt-country songwriting. It changes a little bit in Summer Teeth. That's kind of a bridge record, right? And then in sort of the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, Ghost Is Born, Sky Blue Sky period, that's sort of like, it's
they
weird.
Go, they sort of went in threes. Three albums. They went in threes for a while, yeah.
You know, and I think this is just such an interesting record because the band Wilco that kind of we know now starts to form on this record. It's sort of like this is a huge pivot in the band's career. And I think it's really fascinating to kind of see where they are now and to go back and you can kind of trace that line all the way back to this.
I think it's the sort of three album arcs they do. I was actually going to bring that up as well because I noticed, and I think they're still doing it, which is interesting. I'm curious as to whenever they put out their next record, if that will continue this sort of three album. Mm-hmm.
And then the one after that
will be, who knows?
Yeah. Synth pop Wilco.
Yeah. I mean, you know,
they're big krautrock guys.
So. Yeah. And even like, I think the piano on this record, like Michael Jorgensen joining the band.
Yeah.
The like prevalence of the piano throughout is a big thing that you don't get in previous. Well, like the piano is there, but it's kind of, it's less dominant. Whereas here, like, I think this is the first time in this band that they have an actual piano player.
Yeah. Tweedy in his book, which we will reference at length today, Jeff Tweedy talks about how piano specifically in the first three records was just sort of Jay Bennett kind of messing around.
Yeah.
Like he knew how to play piano. He was a great piano player, but he wasn't a keyboardist.
Yeah.
So adding Jorgensen and then later Sansone as well and Leroy Bach on this album was the first time they're like, oh, let's get some real like hefty organ and keys on here.
Synths too, you know.
Yeah. Speaking of additions to the band, I thought for sure you were going to pick Sky Blue Sky.
Uh-huh.
Just the first one with Nels Klein on
it. Yeah. I mean, I think the interesting thing, and we can probably go on about this, but I think a lot of the kind of groundwork and the necessitating the addition for Nels Klein kind of comes through here now and kind of like it on A Ghost Is Born, kind of with Jim O'Rourke also kind of pushing it onto Tweedy to be like, hey, we need
guitar.
Yeah, it needs to be like more interesting, you know.
We'll get into this later when we get to Nels, but like, it's not just that he's an incredible guitar player; it's what he does with the guitar, and you're like, this is different than anything else anyone is doing.
Mm-hmm.
But we are not talking about Sky Blue Sky.
We are not.
We're going to talk about A Ghost Is Born. We're going to talk about it after this. All right, so to get to A Ghost Is Born, we just kind of touched on it a little bit. Wilco went through some paths from Uncle Tupelo and their earlier sound to get to this point. Jake, run us through what's leading up to A Ghost Is Born.
So as Steve sort of alluded to as well, this was a massive period of change for Wilco. They had just released Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, which basically imploded the band literally and figuratively. Jay Bennett was fired from the band, ironically, as we'll get into, for his pill usage. Ken Coomer was also replaced on drums by Glenn Cochi because Jim O'Rourke, who produced this record and also mixed Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, him and Tweedy and Glenn Cochi formed Loose Fur and basically decided to take the sounds they made from that band and put it into Wilco, regardless of what anyone thought. And that became sort of the soundscapes and everything that made Yankee Hotel Foxtrot what it was. The band also had a falling out with their record label. Time Warner, which owned Warner Brothers, merged with America Online in 2001. That's a very 2001 sentence, leading to more pressure on Warner's record labels to cut costs. Over 600 employees of Warner Music Group were fired, including Howie Klein, who was the president of Reprise Records, which was Wilco's record label. In his absence, David Kahn became the interim head of Reprise. He assigned Mijo Vukovic to monitor the progress of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and to offer suggestions. And music journalist Greg Kot, who has a book called Wilco Learning to Die, claims that Vukovic disdained the album and was unhappy that Wilco were not amenable to his suggestions to change it.
I find it so interesting that David Kahn made poor changes at the head of that company and the Minnesota Timberwolves.
It might be Kane. There's an E at the end here. It's K-H-N-E, so it might be Kane.
I was going to say, you said that very European-sounding name. I'm like, yeah, the Nikola Pekovic parallels. This lines
Pekovic,
up. It's
there's a Vukovic here.
Yeah, exactly. It's the same guy, for sure.
When Wilco brought the album to Warners, they said there was no single, and so the album was rejected by the label, which caused Wilco to say, fuck it, and leave. And their negotiation for the buyout was, instead of financial compensation, the band agreed to leave the label if they were given the master tapes of Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, which they did.
Smart.
This was a fun note that I found. To curb the negative publicity, Reprise began investing more in bands such as the Flaming Lips. Wayne Coyne once said, "We're benefiting from the label's regret over Wilco. We're living in a golden age of that being such a public mistake. The people on Warner said, we'll never have a band like Wilco feel like we don't believe in them again. They tell me it would never happen to us, and what a great day for me." So also at this time, one of the biggest changes was between Yankee Hotel Foxtrot and Ghost Is Born. Wilco backed the band The Minus Five on the album Down With Wilco. The engineer of that record was Michael Jorgensen, who would then join Wilco on keys for the Yankee Hotel Foxtrot tour, and then he joined the band in full. So the band going into the formation of Ghost Is Born was Jeff Tweedy, John Stewart on bass, Michael Jorgensen, and Glenn Coachey.
And the ghost of the music industry.
And the ghost of the music industry.
Yes, this heavy, heavy weight. The specter.
It's crazy. You know, usually people get treated really well in the music industry.
It's weird, right? That they love this respecting artists.
This is the first time this has come up in 13 episodes, an artist That's not true, being treated actually. Well yeah. by a label. I can't believe it.
So recording for A Ghost Is Born began in November 2003. The album was originally going to be called Wilco Happens. I'm very glad they changed that because that's not a good name for a record. Players were Tweedy on lead guitar and vocals, John Stewart on bass and guitar, Glenn Coachey played drums, Michael Jorgensen played keys, Jim O'Rourke served as both producer and multi-instrumentalist, and Leroy Bach also played a variety of keyboards and guitar.
Sorry, I have a question. Is Tweedy the only member of Wilco that's lasted the entire time?
Stewart, no, John Stewart has. Okay. Yeah. John Stewart was, both of them were in Uncle Tupelo.
Yes. Okay.
And then they split off. When Uncle Tupelo split, Jay Farr formed Sunvolt, and everyone else in Uncle Tupelo formed Wilco.
Okay.
And then they've been through Spinal Tap level of band changes up to this point.
Okay.
But Stewart and Tweedy have stayed consistent the whole time. And now that Tweedy was the only guitar player left in the band because Jay Bennett was no longer in the band, Jim O'Rourke pushed Tweedy to up his guitar skills for this album.
Which he really did.
And he really did.
Yeah.
And I actually wanted to talk to you about this, Steve, as a guitarist. I find the guitar solos on this record to be very unique sounding.
Yeah.
It's a lot of like skronks.
It's very, I saw something, I can't remember where, I think it was in the, there's that interview with Chuck Klosterman.
The Spin article.
In 2004 for Spin. Just kind of talking about how, you know, television were kind of a more influential kind of leaping off point for him than sort of like the Grateful Dead. And so, you know, it's kind of like less.
Oh, that exact note.
Yeah.
Notes.
It's sort of like less, maybe I saw it in your notes, but. It's not as noodly as you might expect from kind of a folk rock band, you know? And I think that's sort of like foundation of it's very melodic and it's very kind of angular and not, it's concerned less, say, with like technical perfection than it is with kind of capturing the right energy and the right feel, which I think when generally you're recording a guitar solo, I mean, this is kind of sacrilege as a Fish fan, but like,
Shorter than 14 minutes.
Going for that energy, although on this record some of them aren't.
That's fair.
Going for that energy and that sort of like vibe is so much more important in a setting like this. And I think, like, you know, even on like, at least that's what you said, it's a through composed thing. Like, he kind of plays that every time, like when you hear it live, it's that, right? I think in doing that, it really kind of like opens up a lot of what the band can be. And I think it kind of necessitates having a Nels Klein type who can kind of use that as a leaping off.
Now, how do you go about that change if you're someone in Tweedy's position, though? Is this like did he just have the guitar chops before and he didn't make it an emphasis of his own individual part in the band?
He talks a little bit about that in the book.
Okay.
He always says that he was a good guitar player, but he very much considered himself and still considered himself to be like okay
as a guitarist. Because you're the front man and you have a guitar, but you have a guitarist most
of
the time.
He was also never a lead guitarist up to this point. Like even in Uncle Tupelo, he played bass when that band started. And Jay Farrar was the lead guitarist, and then he had Jay Bennett with him here.
Yeah, so I'm kind of thinking in my head, like is this like, oh, he locked in the gym and got threes up for a summer, or is this just like more of a philosophical like approach change?
Vicodin?
There's a lot
of Vicodin.
Yeah, so much.
Yeah. But like technically he also got better?
I think so, but I think you know, a lot of that is probably just like a little bit of both.
Okay.
There's definitely, you know, he's going to have to, in terms of like kind of doing three composed solos, say for like, again, at least that's what you said, or even some of those lines like on Theologians when that do-do-do-do-do-do, you know, that sort of stuff, like you have to kind of sit down and like actually spend the time to come up with those melodies and learn them and kind of figure out how they're going to be phrased. It doesn't sound like there's a ton of improvising.
Okay.
In a lot of this, even though it is very kind of like scrunky and out there, that's sort of like, there's a lot of intent.
Okay.
But I do think he kind of like, this forced him to be kind of become a much better guitar player. And harmonically speaking too, just like the songs are more complicated in terms of the chord progressions. This is when they kind of start to go that way. There's not that, you know, kind of Ashes of American Flags or like I'm Trying to Break Your Heart where it's kind of just four chords the whole time and it's so effective, but here there's a lot more going on. When I sat down on the bed next to you started to cry. I said maybe if I leave you'll want me to come back home. Maybe all you mean is leave me alone. At least that's what you said.
Is a nice little segue into what this album is actually about. So the final guitar solo at the end of At Least What You Said, Jeff Tweedy said was supposed to sound like what his panic attacks feel like. The reason that Jeff Tweedy was having constant panic attacks was because he was viciously addicted to Vicodin at this time.
I will say, my panic attacks do not sound like this album.
Well, they probably aren't caused by opioid withdrawal.
Yes, they're not.
Prior to recording this album, Jeff Tweedy's mental state was beginning to deteriorate because of his addiction to opioids. And according to his book, which is called Let's Go So We Can Get Back, which is great. If you haven't read it, you should. Tweedy said that he thought that during the recording of this album, he was going to die. He writes in the book, "Band was aware that I was unhappy and struggling with depression, but they had no idea how serious my drug use had become. I think the looming sense of imminent demise came across in the songs. The lyrical elements of A Ghost Is Born were originally conceived as a Noah's Ark analogy. That's why I had so many animal songs. A Ghost Is Born would be a gift to my kids, who could turn it on when they were older and put together the pieces of me a little bit, more than I'd been able to put myself together for them in real life." So he was literally planning to leave this as his, like, postmortem of an album. Because he was going through this cycle of being addicted to Vicodin, and he said he didn't want to record high. But when you're addicted to Vicodin and you stop taking it, you get horrible, horrible migraines, apparently. So he recorded the majority of this album dealing with constant panic attacks from addiction, constant migraines from addiction, and then, or just being high on Vicodin. There's a song on this record.
That sounds unpleasant.
Sounds terrible. There's a song on this record that I'm sure is Steve's favorite song on this record, which is called Less Than You Think. Less Than You Think is a 15-ish minute song whose last 13 minutes is just feedback and noise. Tweety called it the song that everyone will hate and defended the inclusion of the album to Greg Kot in his book, Wilco Learning to Die. He said, I know 99% of our fans won't like that song and they'll say it's a ridiculous indulgence. Even I don't want to listen to it every time we play through the album. But the times I do calm myself down and pay attention to it, I think it's valuable and moving and cathartic. I wouldn't have put it on the record if I didn't think it was great. I wanted to make an album about identity, and within that idea of a higher power, the idea of randomness, that anything can happen and that we can't control it. In the book, he says that it has an outro built on glacial electronic drones and slowly evolving repetitive mechanical noises arranged to mimic the isolating alien landscapes migraines often induce when the pain wraps itself so tightly around your skull, it starts to warp your perception of light and time. I can't remember if that was the original intent during tracking, but that's what my mind was focused on when we were doing the final mix.
Your mind's a machine. It's deadly and dull. It's never been still, and its will has never been free. Lightly tapping, high-pitched drum. Your spine starts to shine, and you shiver at your soul. A fist so clear and climbing, more chills a hole in the sky, so you can see for yourself if you don't believe me. There's so much less to this than you think.
Oh, I have feelings.
Share them.
There's that like little jump, like a tonal modulation, just very quickly that drone kind of runs out
when they when,
and then it just
when
goes,
it switches,
and it just pops up like maybe a tone, semitone.
That's I have so good. A question for you, Steve. And I don't. I know sometimes I tease you about the feedback stuff, but yeah. Like when you did that show at the Transat, where you know that was a lot of what you were doing. Mm-hmm. Was this something that like made you want to play around with that kind of stuff, or
I, you know, like. It would be revisionist for me to say yes.
Okay.
Because I don't think I like fully understood ambient music at the time.
Okay.
Right. It's like a, maybe like a subconscious influence.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of
there
things,
just isn't a lot of it, right?
No. Yeah. One of the things going back and re-listening to this is like, I kind of agree in terms of like how they kind of talk about needing to include this as like part of, first of all, the symmetry kind of with, at least that's what you said, and Less Than You Think kind of bookending the record just in terms of like taking a very radical shift 2.5 to 3 minutes kind of into the song, I think is just such an, it's they, and they do it in two completely different ways, which I think is such a fascinating thing to do. The note that I have written down here is like, they also do like a really quintessential like 1970s thing where they're like ending technically on the ballad.
Right.
Which a lot of 70s records end on ballads.
And Tweety actually, again, in the book, makes the point that a big influence on this record was Glenn Cochee and Michael Jorgensen are apparently obsessed with 70s kraut rock and 70s rock music. Mm-hmm. And this was like, Tweedy has said a lot of times that he says it when he's talking about like Uncle Tupelo days. He was very conscious of like understanding where music they're playing came from in the past. Where, like, obviously Uncle Tupelo covered No Depression and all that stuff, but always wanting to sort of go forward. And despite the fact he loves all that music, he wanted to drive forward with this music. But it's interesting that this is like allowing those 70s influences.
Yeah, it's a total 70s rock record. So many end on ballads,
which, Jake, you must have hated for a long time.
I mean,
Jake's whole thing that's come up a couple times is that because he was a theater kid, the closing number should be a big closing number.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And like they do close on late greats, but that's also sort of a like jaunty tune. Like it's not a big showstopper.
Although I do think there's a really interesting kind of thing here where you have the ballad, you have kind of all of that ambient kind of feedback and noise. I don't know if you remember this, but on the CD, and I think there's something to be, there's kind of a bit of a medium is the message thing with Wilco in this period where they were recording knowing that it was going to come out on CD, which yes. is a fundamental, like this is not, there was no vinyl being pressed for these, or very little vinyl being pressed for records like this.
Funny enough, you say that they did upload this
yes,
to the internet.
They did, yeah.
For free.
But I think like a big thing about this is that is sort of a buffer. On the CD, the late greats was a hidden track.
Yes.
It wasn't on the track listing.
Right, because there's the 13 minutes of feedback and then...
So if you didn't know and you hadn't like fast-forwarded or whatever, the late greats was kind of like a reward for getting through
right.
that like 13 minutes of kind of drone and
hey,
ambience.
Thanks for going through that with me. Yeah. Now you have an idea. Yeah. And here's, you know, here's something here's to feel a little
treat,
bit better
you
about.
Know? Yeah. I think about this more. Not that I ever think CDs are going to come back the way vinyl does, but I think a really interesting thing about a lot of these records that came out in this period, like A Yankee Hotel Foxtrot, like Ghost Is Born, Illinois by Sufjan Stevens is a similar one. Yoshimi Battles of Pink Robots, kind of these early 2000s indie rock records are CD medium records. They all the stuff kind of bleeds together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very dependent on being able to digest it in one sitting without having to do anything.
Well, like shuffling with CDs was, A, it ruined the CDs.
Yeah.
And B, you'd have to like, between each song, you'd hear your CD player whirring and grinding. And
right.
Like the idea of this, the way we listen to music now of just like, oh, I'm just going to put it on shuffle. You could do it,
yeah,
but you didn't.
Now you almost want to, I mean, at least with some bands and some genres, you want to get away from that entirely because you want the songs to be standalone songs you can pull out on, for, especially with streaming.
I'm curious as to now that, like, I listen to music on shuffle all the time now, but I still, every time
you
I have it, every time there's a new album, not I would never listen to an album the first time on
yeah,
shuffle.
Yeah, yeah.
So like every time there's a new album I want to digest, it's always the first 5 to 6 listens are always front to back. And I'm curious if like the sort of Gen Z generation, if when an album they like comes out, if that's still the case. And I don't mean this as a criticism, I mean as a question. When new Ariana Grande CD comes out, do the kids who are into Ariana Grande, does Ariana Grande not care about album sequencing?
I'm sure she does. I'm sure from an artist perspective, I just wonder if there's going to be a lot of like 29-minute, 5-song optimized for streaming.
Mm. Yeah.
It's, again, medium determining the message, Shouts to Marshall McLuhan. I thought it was so funny when they started reissuing all these Wilco records on vinyl. Because
right.
they were double records. And you're like, but it doesn't,
so
I don't have two turntables.
So they're all like $34.
Yeah, well, yeah. I don't have to, but it's like, you need two turntables.
So you don't have to
do it
get
properly,
switch,
right? And
yeah.
that's why like a lot of those old 70s double records are like side one, side three, side two, side four.
Right,
right.
So you can
because
switch it over while the other sides
dual,
playing.
Dual record players, like, that's kind of why DJs start doing that, so that it was continuous music.
Steve was just doing a
record,
scratching. Steve
DJ
is scratching
Steve
in
yeah.
the booth over here.
But like, you know, two turntables exist because a lot of old home stereos in the 70s had two turntables so that you could load the next side of a
and
record
just,
that you wanted. To, exactly.
Interesting.
Right. This is like a Will the Circle Be Unbroken by the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band.
Of course.
It's like a one.
top album on the Colgate Hour.
Anyway,
yeah. Roy Donk just going ham on that album.
It's just like, it's funny to see how the push toward reviving vinyl has actually broken up the flow of certain records that were not meant to be on that medium. And I think Wilco's stuff kind of in this time period is very kind of endemic of that.
Especially these two, Yankee and Ghost Is Born are, you're right, they are one play.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like a 12-song, 66-minute album is just like, that's not going to work super well.
For you think with the back, like side B, so to speak, or side D, I guess, of Yankee, the idea of like Poor Places and Reservations not being one song in a way is, like, I saw them in October and they played Reservations. And they did not play Poor Places, and it was almost jarring.
Yeah.
It was like, oh, there's half of this song doesn't exist, but it's an entirely different song.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Sorry. That was an aside, but.
The other song on Ghost Is Born that deals with Tweety going insane is the other long song on this record, Spider's Kid Smoke, which is
a perfect length and a perfect song.
Spider's singing in the salty breeze. Spider's
So in the book, Tweety says that Spider's Kid Smoke is another recording where I feel like you can hear my condition pretty clearly. Because of its length, getting a great full take felt unlikely with the window on my ability to remain upright closing fast. So we reconstructed the song to be as minimal as possible with the fewest number of chord changes. This allowed me to just recite the lyrics and punctuate them with guitar skronks and scribbles to get through the song without having to concentrate past my headache too much. We attempted two takes, and take one is the one on the record. Take two was incomplete. So
that you hear the improvising there.
Yes.
I think they had a lot more.
And I think it was out of like literal physical necessity because he couldn't stand upright for 13 minutes to play the song.
Yeah.
Which, like, oof.
The other thing I think you hear on this track on the record is you hear them using the studio.
Yeah.
A lot more than on the rest of the record, where it's kind of like, I don't want to say that the song wasn't fully written, but because it's a little bit more wide open, a little bit more minimal in terms of that crowdy rock kind of thing, when those guitars drop in on the B section, they come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
Like on headphones, they come out of nowhere. And that's like a very much like a, we recorded them in the studio and they're just going to go, where you don't hear,
how are they gonna go?
They drop down like that.
Bop.
But it is like literally probably that Pro Tool session. They just like, here they are. We're gonna stack them here so that it's loud and it's effective. But it's not. There's no guitar. You don't hear that guitar leading up into the other section.
To your point about sort of the necessity of Nels Klein when they play this now.
Yeah.
There's the whole thing is Nels slowly building and building and building on the guitar until those guitars come in. And so I think clearly Tweety couldn't build it because he would have fallen down.
Well, and
but also that space, like, and I'll get into this a little bit when we talk about Nels joining, but like Tweety has talked about how there was all this space in their songs and they needed guys to fill it. And that's what Nels was brought in to do.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes you can hear the like recording studio element of a record in a way that like kind of takes you out of it. Like you can hear like where the track was edited and you're like, oh, that.
You know, or you can feel it if hear it.
And then, but I think you can kind of go sort of through the looking glass with it, and then that's part of it. Where and I think they talk about using the studio as a creative tool a lot on this record, and just sort of being like, we came in and made it, knowing that we weren't going to be tracking it live off the floor as a band. We were just going to be making this record as like pastiche, or as kind of however we could do it, right? I can't stand up for 13 minutes. And I think it's really interesting to be able to kind of hear that. And I think you hear it on Spiders, like the process of them making this record is like very evident.
I saw them play it in 2016. It almost sounds like a different song now. Like it's structurally the same and the same lyrics, but it's a completely different experience listening to them play it now, or even on like the Kicking Television live record. It's a totally different song, which I think is really interesting.
Yeah.
That Kicking Television live record.
It's so good.
Yes.
Oh my God, it's so good.
So that was the tour that I saw them on, and I found something very funny.
Oh boy.
So I saw them at Massey Hall on October 9th, 2004.
Okay.
And they were joined for a couple of the songs. They played a couple of the songs from the Billy Bragg record by Garth Hudson from the band, which I think is an interesting parallel for us as a generation, because the thing that feels closest to the band is kind of Wilco. That could be a whole other podcast. A week later, October 16th, a fan in Massachusetts jumped on stage and grabbed Jeff Tweedy around the waist, and Jeff Tweedy punched him in the face.
It's interesting. I've heard that story before, and it's funny, like now after like reading his book and seeing Wilco sort of in the 2010s, yeah. I remember when I first heard of Wilco and got into Wilco when I was in high school, Tweedy was known as like this curmudgeonly
mercurial,
difficult guy.
Yeah.
And now he's so like nice and affable and such a dad, and like guesting on Parks and Rec and writing this book.
He also put out a statement after that, like, I mean, rightfully, but it's kind of, instead of apologizing, he just like blamed security.
Yeah.
He said, if I had felt safer, then I wouldn't have needed to do that.
It's the first time the security guards have ever been bad at me, too.
Yeah. He did say, I feel terrible. I don't like to punch someone in the face. Yeah. It sucks.
Yeah. So, you know, but this was to discover this band in 2004, it was life-changing stuff.
When we finish history, I do want to get into that idea.
No, let's talk about it right now.
Okay.
Because we can zoom through. Everyone knows how this was received, right? We can kind of zoom through that part of it. Because I know that you have a weird feeling with Wilco.
Yes, which is what I want to discuss, especially with Steve, because I think we share a lot of thoughts about Wilco.
And we will talk about that after this. Okay, so Jake, Wilco is one of your favorite bands, but you don't, and it's a weird thing, and maybe it's difficult to have that level of connection and empathy to an album that is clearly so personal for Jeff Tweedy and what he was going through, and maybe you can't relate, but you don't, this is like, you've said this before, it's like one of your favorite albums that you don't really feel
much. Not just the album, because like the album has, like I said earlier, like everyone has their own personal history with albums, and I think the artist's history and your history are kind of like, it doesn't matter if they're different. Like the fact that I don't have an opioid addiction doesn't mean that this album wasn't important to me at a time. But my thing with Wilco is that like all of my favorite bands, like if I was to give a top five, they're all like bands that mean a lot to people and to me. Like it's all about community and like certain like people who like these bands really fucking like these bands. Wilco is my favorite band that I have no emotional attachment to. And I find that for someone like me who like, when I like a band, I really like a band and I get really deep into it. It's an odd dichotomy for me because I love Wilco, but I don't, like, I just don't have any connection to them other than the fact that I think they're amazing and I love their music. And I know that's enough and you don't have to be like indebted to a band in your own personal psyche to have
probably
a favorite band.
It's probably healthy to have some bands like that where probably. It's just like, hey, today I want to listen to some good music, but I don't really want to like be nostalgic or get in my feelings or whatever. Right. I'll throw this on.
We chose the wrong album for me to be like that, to be talking about that.
That's great then. Because obviously it means something a lot more to you.
Yeah.
But this is my point. And I find myself as I get older listening to a lot more Wilco. And I think it's because it's just, A, I like listening.
Yeah, it's really good.
But like, helps. I don't have to sort of go anywhere, so to speak, to listen to Wilco. It's just like, oh, okay, I'm going to listen to a kick-ass record today.
We're also like closer in age to where Tweedy was when he made this. You know, I think that might be a kind of a thing where, like, you could be closer in age to some of the other bands that you identify with in a more kind of visceral, like, emotional way.
Yeah, I think
way.
That, yeah, like, when I identify with, like, a Jeff Rosenstock song about getting older and, like, needing a job, obviously that hits deeper than Jeff Tweedy's metaphors about Vicodin addiction.
I think he was 36 in 2004 when this record was made.
Yeah, that's an interesting
point.
They
are an older, it's true, they are an older band.
They're, like, for all the jokes that can be made about them being dad rock, they are dads.
I mean, he literally plays in a band with his sons.
Yeah.
And I do wonder how much, you know, that would be different for someone who was around Tweedy's age at this time and like followed them. You know, obviously we were all too young when they first came on the scene. Like, we can go back and listen to those albums and appreciate them, but like, we were like 7 and 8 years
old.
It's
a kind of a different connection to time and place.
And to your point about that too, I think I could think of bands that are older, for lack of a better word, that I do have an intense emotional connection to. But when I think about how that was formed, that has more to do with when I started listening to them
than the
lyrical content or the, like, cause I listened to Wilco in high school, but it wasn't, they weren't one of my bands.
Yeah.
You know?
See
like I have a huge emotional attachment to the Replacements, but I got into them in that way.
Yeah.
And Wilco was like, this is a cool record.
Yeah, no. Yeah.
But tell us more about your connection to it.
I think it's just that perfect kind of mix of, like, I was starting to get serious about the guitar at the time. It was one of those bands that felt like not a lot of people that I knew liked them. There were probably like 5 or 6 people that I went to high school with that liked them.
On the message boards?
On the message boards, yeah. My high school had, the school sponsored the creation of an online, like, message board community. And one of the ones we talked about was, like, we talked about Wilco a lot. There were like 60 of us. Then like one thread. It was some seriously dorky shit. But, you know, kind of being taking the guitar seriously at the time, and it wasn't like anything. You know, at the time was in a band that was covering Choking Victim, and like like was listening, you know, the Planet Smashers and like a lot of like punk rock and kind of like
weird that your influences were ska.
Well, no, look, I've never been one to deny the influence. I've just refused to embrace it fully.
other than, you know, being extremely successful in a ska band. Yeah.
But, you know, and
just add a horn, like, for the next album.
Kind of. I had a horn arrangement ready to go for the last record. It just got cut.
Please tell me it's somewhere on your computer. Mm-mm. Damn.
It was handwritten.
I used to play trumpet. Give it to me. I'll figure it out.
but you know, like, and kind of starting to even understand the, like, historical significance of Massey Hall and mm-hmm. getting to have this band, have this record come out after I had already kind of sat with Yankee Hotel Foxtrot a little bit. I'm pretty sure I got Being There and AM. Here's a meta tie-in from Columbia House.
Hey.
There you go.
And I just,
oh, yeah, that's our name.
Yeah.
That's Chappie.
And Nels Klein being my first experience of Nels Klein as sort of this guy that didn't fit anywhere. He was too rock and roll for jazz, and he was too jazz for rock and roll, and he was noisy and freaky looking, and I'd never... The only other person I'd seen play a jazz master was fucking Elvis Costello. So I was like, and I was like smoking weed, you know? So it's just like,
by the way, Tweedy, when he plays as Land Ho in Parks and Rec, is playing a jazz master.
I don't even know Parks and Rec that well though. Like,
yeah, the song,
I just thought I'd point it out because you mentioned jazz master.
They play Pickled Ginger, which is off the Star Wars record.
Okay. Right.
It's too short a clip. I couldn't.
And it just,
if you didn't know it, you wouldn't.
It was one of those things where, like, you know, even like theologians being like, I love Bad Religion, I'm an atheist. Theologians don't know nothing about my soul. Like, you're like, what?
Slow motion.
I think, is my favorite Wilco song.
Really?
I think so.
Yeah.
I have a question for you, Steve.
Yeah.
So at that point, you were somewhere in the 14 to 16 range, as you were.
We're not sure.
But like at this point, obviously you were playing guitar and you were big into music, but like you were still a couple of years away from deciding to go to school for music and like obviously eventually committing your life to music. Did you know at that point kind of, or were you still trying to figure it out and music was like an interest, or were you like, oh, I'm a music guy already at that stage?
This would have been right around the time that I started to kind of have the like big schism of being like, do I want to try and be Joey Votto or do I want to play the guitar?
Yes.
Right, because I was
a, yes, we know, you were a lanky first baseman who could take a walk. Everyone knows.
No, yeah, so it was right, this was right around the time that it, as it started to kind of get serious, it all just like, and I had to kind of reflect on it for this, but like, you know, obviously going back and looking at it with the benefit of 15 plus years, it's kind of like, oh, here was a huge turning point, and this is a huge turning point record for me. And
well, the baseball world hates you, Jeff Tweedy,
yeah,
and
yeah,
Nels Klein.
You stole this from us.
Canada could be a baseball powerhouse. Imagine two Joey's Votto,
yes.
One of you would have to move off of first base in the Olympic years, but
yeah,
or the World Baseball Classic years.
Yeah, you know, like literally this was right around the time when my folks were like, we can afford to buy you a Telecaster, like a real guitar, or you can go play for the like traveling baseball team. It was like right around this time in my life. And I chose the guitar. And that's the guitar that I've used still to this day on basically every record we've made.
Which guitar is
it? It's a Telecaster.
Is that the Sunburst
one? Yeah, it's the Sunburst Telecaster. It's in my room now. I don't take it on the road anymore, but
it's a nice guitar.
Yeah. My baby.
This album was well received by Steve Sladkowski.
Yes.
Well received by Jake Goldsby.
Yes.
Jake, how did everyone else receive?
Peaked at number 8 on the Billboard 200. It got kind of like B grades from all the reviewers. B from Entertainment Weekly, 6.6 from Pitchfork. Rolling Stone gave it 4 stars.
6.6 is fucking cold-blooded.
Village Voice gave it a B-. I guarantee if they reviewed it now, it'd be a 9. It won the Best Alternative Album Grammy. But as we've sort of talked around, the most important thing that came out of this record was the addition of Pat Sansone and Nels Klein to the band. For a band that changed their lineup seemingly weekly up to this point, it's kind of amazing that the band has not changed since Sansone and Klein were added to the band.
Not to bring it back to baseball, but yeah, Tweedy was very much a like Mark Shapiro, like let's turn those 23, 24, 25.
Value.
Yeah.
A lot of surplus value.
He says now that he has great regret that he didn't just make this band from the get-go.
That's such a strange thing to say.
I would have simply, without it, it wouldn't happen. I would have simply gotten Nels Klein right away to be in my band.
He said that...
got him out of the Geraldine Fibbers.
When he talks about the band formation now, he says in the book, he says, I thought I'd lose my mind if I tried to sort through the infinite possibilities this band would have access to in a studio as instrument scenario. Nels Klein alone seemed like he could cause permanent damage to my fragile post-hospital psyche just by running through his repertoire of pedal combinations. Playing live forced everyone to be decisive when choosing their parts and sounds and to stay focused on how the band sounded as a collective thing. One sound we were all making together.
He's one of the few people on the planet who can use a Korg Chaos Pad and not be a complete asshole.
Correct.
Holy.
And uses it so well.
I just Googled Nels Klein pedal board.
Oh yeah.
I thought yours was overwhelming, Steve.
He has a table for stuff.
Yeah. I'm so jealous.
Yeah, this is the one. The one I'm looking at here is a two-parter that has 15 or 16 different ones on it, but it looks like there are bigger ones.
And he still uses the like crappy blue Boss compressor, which is like the dirtiest sounding pedal. It's insane. I love it.
So Wilco have obviously kept going with this 6-piece lineup in place. They put out Sky Blue Sky in 2007, Wilco the album in 2009, The Whole Love in 2011, Star Wars in 2015, Schmilko in 2016, and Ode to Joy in 2019, which is a kick-ass record.
Mm-hmm. So that's a lot of records.
Yeah.
We're not going to rank them, right? That's what we decided to not do that.
Yeah. Just for fun, though, Steve, I'm curious, as a Wilco fan.
Yes.
What are your favorite Wilco songs? More or less. I don't need
my favorite Wilco songs. Oh, man.
Don't need like an exact ranking, but just curious.
I love War on War. I love How to Fight Loneliness. I love the song Monday.
It's a good
from
song.
Being There.
Yeah, it's a great tune.
I also like Walkin'.
Yeah, I love Walkin'. So this be, and this was Ghost is your favorite Wilco record.
I probably wouldn't have said that at the beginning of the podcast, but now that we're talking really? About it, I think it might be. Yeah.
What
this,
would you have said?
This happens though. It's
It's happened to me before
on
the show.
I probably would have said Sky Blue Sky just because
it's a Nels record.
It's a Nels record. And you know, I think as a contrast for people who are listening, I think it's really interesting to listen to Ghost is Born and then contrast it with Sky Blue Sky, because it's essentially that one is live off the floor, pretty much. They took that touring band and just put them right in the studio.
And Tweedy talks about that in the book. He says, like, they put that on the floor live because they wanted to show that, like, going from this insanely personal, horrendous experience, they just wanted to go into the studio and make a nice record with this new band. Just be like, okay, we can do this.
I probably learned and stole more from Sky Blue Sky.
That's fair.
But I think this is the record that kind of sort of tipped my brain into the direction that it still tumbles down.
How to Fight Loneliness as one of your favorite tracks is a good choice.
It's a great song.
Also, maybe one of the best opening Tweedy lyrics, which is a Jeff Tweedy special.
Yeah. So when we were debating what to do with rankings for this episode, we could have done songs good and albums because Wilco have so many songs and albums. But Tweedy is known for, and I think one of the best at, if not the best at, writing opening lyrics to songs.
Yes. Yeah. Always evocative, always engaging.
Yeah. So I thought we'd say our like 3 to 5 favorite Jeff Tweedy opening lines.
Let's say 3. Are we going to go, no, we're not allowed to repeat it if someone takes it? Like,
yeah, I prepared extras just in case.
I prepared five.
Yeah.
So,
I've got 6.
I assume we all have one.
We have a couple. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, lead us off, Steve. Oh, boy. Okay. The Ashtray Says You Were Up All Night.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah, yeah. Love that one.
Shot in the Arm. Summer Teeth.
Great song.
Yeah. Yeah. When You Went to Bed with Your Darkest Mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I love that imagery of just like, oh, yeah, you can tell what kind of.
Yeah, we've all been there. even if you don't smoke cigarettes.
Yeah. I had How to Fight Loneliness at the top of mind. How to Fight Loneliness, Smile All the Time, Shine Your Teeth Till Meaningless, Sharpen Them with Lies.
I have Handshake Drugs. I was chewing gum for something to do. The blinds are being pulled down on the dew. Inside Out of Love, What a Laugh, I Was Looking for You.
I had that one too.
Me too.
I was chewing gum for something to do. The blinds are being pulled down on the dew. Inside Out of Love, What a Laugh, I Was Looking for You. Saxophones started blowing me down. I was buried in sound. Taxi cabs are driving me around. To the handshake drugs I bought downtown. To the handshake drugs I bought downtown.
John Strad is Rick Danko. They're the band. They are our band.
I've never made that comparison because I have to admit, I'm not a huge fan of the band. Like, I understand their place and their importance, but like, they've just never really connected with me. But now that you're saying this and have said it a couple of times, now I think I might need to go back. And
this is something that I was just kind of really thinking about when I started prepping for this. But yeah, they're the band. Like, Rick Danko is that sort of like, yeah, he sang lead, but Rick Danko as like the master of background vocal, like backup vocal. And John Strat, like these melodic bassline vocal harmony stuff. It's anyway.
Steve, let's give us another line.
Oh, I am an American aquarium drinker. I assassin down the avenues.
Bit of a tongue twister there, right?
Which he also notes in the book means nothing.
Yeah.
People ask him about it all the time. He said it fit the rhythm.
And it fits the rhythm, and it is so wonderfully alliterative.
Yeah. It's a great line.
Ugh. Yeah, I'm trying to break your heart.
I had Misunderstood, which is Jeff Tweedy writing a Wonder Years song, basically.
Oh my God.
When you're back in your old neighborhood, the cigarettes taste so good, but you're so misunderstood.
Yeah.
I went with a new song.
Okay,
there you go.
From Everyone Hides, which was the single off Ode to Joy. Mm-hmm. If you're telling yourself a story where the secrets twist like vines, and you know where the bodies are buried, but you can't remember where you buried the mines. Just a really well-written line.
Yeah. A lot going on there. All right, let's do one more each.
Speaking of burying bodies.
I assume you have the one that I assume we all have.
I dreamed about killing you again last night, and it felt all right to me. Via Chicago. Summer Teeth might be the most... Like, here's Jeff Tweedy showing up, flexing that particular muscle.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And Via Chicago, I think, sort of spawned this idea for me. Because I think that's the best one of all his opening lines. Because it's just so especially that song. That song's so weird, too, that you're just, what a perfect song.
Another good one, the title track off that album, Summer Teeth. Maybe I just like it as a writer. But like a cloud, his fingers explode. On the typewriter ribbon, the shadow grows.
And I'm going to... close it out with Ash's American Flags. The cash machine is blue and green for 120s and a small service fee.
All right. That's a lot of Wilco songs.
God, Jeff Tweedy kicks ass.
That leads us to what I imagine will be the hardest part of this podcast. Steve, every time we wrap up an episode, we pick a song from the album we discussed to go on our living mixtape. What song off of A Ghost Is Born are we putting on this mixtape?
Theologians.
I would be fine with that.
That was easier than I thought. I thought Steve was going to just
pick less than you think.
I mean, just interrupt our mixtape with 13 minutes of feedback. Well,
if I was going to do that, I would take Spiders or at least that's what you said. But
so Theologians it is?
Theologians is kind of
it's interesting about the one pick. I think my top four of five Wilco songs are on this record.
Mm.
Like Theologians, at least like you said, Spiders could all easily... Even something like Company on My Back could be in there.
Mm-hmm.
Just, God, I love this record.
Unfortunately, we only get one for the mixtape.
That's fine. It's the best one.
Yeah. All right. Do you guys have any other thoughts before we wrap this up?
I left one lyric out that I think is awesome.
Let's do it.
from Whole Love, My Gold Marigold's Attack.
Yeah.
What? What is that?
I will say Hold Love has aged exceedingly well.
It has, yeah. But God, this is such a good band. They're such a good band.
They really are. Every time I see them, I get mad that I have to wait 2 or 3 years to see them again.
Yeah,
which is always the
sad that I miss them.
I have only seen them once. It was at Turf in 2015.
I was at that show. They played Star Wars front to back.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, guys.
Steve Sladkowski, guys, the guitarist of Pop. I'm sure you've listened to Morbid Stuff if you were listening to mine and Jake's podcast. If you haven't, make sure you turn it on Spotify and just let it stream so the numbers get up. Buy that stuff. Go to pupthaband.com for their awesome merch like that Scorpion Hill hockey jersey, which rules. Steve, you kick ass, man.
Oh, I'm trying.
Thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, great. Of course. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to agree with you on music for once.
Oh, yeah. We can start disagreeing as soon as the mics stop rolling.
As soon as we talk about literally any other
any
album.
Other band.
We found the one album you guys agree on.
We did it.
Please try the fish.